and it's actually a fun time to be talking about short-duration gamma-ray burst. It's been about 8 years since the discovery of the first well-localized short-duration gamma-ray burst, and we've learned quite a lot in the last decade. And in fact, as I'll present today, I think we now have fairly solid evidence that short-duration gamma-ray bursts are caused by the mergers of neutron stars in a binary system or neutron star in a binary system with a black hole. And those, of course, are the sources that Advanced LIGO will presumably find in the coming years. And so that's the second aspect of my talk today, is demonstrating how we can use information about short-duration gamma-ray bursts to motivate our thinking about finding electromagnetic counterparts to gravitational wave sources from LIGO. So gamma-ray bursts are a fascinating phenomenon. They're the most luminous and most energetic type of transient that we know about in the universe. They've been a long-standing mystery for several decades. And so in the talk today at the beginning, I will spend a little bit of time giving you some background information on GRBs, and then I will move from there to focus on the short-duration bursts. So our motivation or objectives in studying short-duration gamma-ray bursts are essentially threefold. First, we want to determine the properties of what until recently was the most poorly understood part of the population of gamma-ray bursts. And in particular, we want to test whether gamma-ray bursts are associated with what's been theoretically the favored model for what's producing these sources, which is the mergers of neutron star binaries or neutron star black hole binaries. And part of the reason we're motivated to do this is that if we can establish this connection, then effectively we have already seen what the electromagnetic counterparts of these sources are going to look like when we look down the axis of the jet. But at the same time, it allows us to anticipate what the electromagnetic counterparts will look like, even if we're looking away from the axis of the jet, which is going to be the bulk of the time. So I will provide evidence for why we even think that these short-duration gamma-ray bursts are collimated in jets, and the fact that these jets are relatively narrow, narrow enough that we only see one out of 50 events or so. So that's the motivation. For my talk today, what I would like to start with is just a very brief history of gamma-ray bursts and what the basic model is for the production of a gamma-ray burst. And then I will demonstrate quickly that the progenitors, the systems that are giving rise to short-duration gamma-ray bursts, are distinct from the long-duration gamma-ray bursts. That will be the first step. And I will then provide further evidence that the progenitors actually are neutron star black hole mergers, as shown here. And again, that's a model that's been around for quite a long time. In fact, it predated the understanding that there were two types of gamma-ray bursts. And then I will talk about what kind of information we can extract about these systems and about the properties of the outflow, the explosion, based on observations both in the gamma rays and also the afterglow, which is the emission that comes afterwards in X-rays, optical, and radio frequencies. And that will allow us to establish what these sources would look like when they're discovered through their gravitational wave emission. And then finally, I will draw implications for the electromagnetic follow-up of LIGO sources based on this information. So gamma-ray bursts are kind of a fascinating story in science in general, where something quite fascinating is discovered completely by accident. And so the discovery of gamma-ray bursts dates back to the mid-1960s. At that time, the Department of Defense launched a series of satellites called the VELA satellites that were designed to detect the signatures, the gamma ray emission, from nuclear tests in space. And instead, what these satellites discovered were these short bursts of gamma ray emission that, through triangulation, were clearly coming from outside of the solar system. But beyond that, the distance scale to these sources was not really known. And then successive generations of these gamma-ray satellites found more and more of these bursts. But really, the big question at the time was, what is actually causing these events, and what is their distance scale? Are they coming from just outside of the solar system? Are they coming from the edge of the universe? Of course, the implications would be very different for the energy scale for these kind of models. So the first real breakthrough came almost 30 years later, when the burst and transient source experiment, which was an instrument on the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, localized a large number of gamma ray bursts, several hundreds, close to 3,000, and showed that their distribution on the sky is completely uniform. And this was really the first indication that these are likely coming from a cosmological origin. They're coming from well outside of the Milky Way. And in fact, that also established the idea that the energy release is enormous. And because of this large energy release, in addition to the gamma ray signal itself, there should be some emission that will be delayed and at longer wavelengths, at lower energy, the so-called afterglow. And this afterglow emission was, in fact, discovered for the first time in 1997. And that really established a lot of the properties of gamma ray bursts. Until that point, the localizations were so poor that any individual burst could not be followed up at other wavelengths. But with the discovery of afterglows, sources could be pinpointed to high precision. So here's an example of a position coming from a gamma ray satellite. And here is a source that appears in an optical image taken within a few hours of the burst discovery, compared to an archival image that was taken many years earlier. And you can see that there is a new source here that was not there previously, and that is the afterglow. And so by pinpointing the position of the afterglow, it was then possible to measure the redshift and the distance scale to gamma ray bursts, which established that they are indeed cosmological in origin. And in fact, at this point, the most distant gamma ray burst that we know about is a redshift of almost 9.5. It's one of the most distant sources known in the universe. So that's only about 500 million years after the Big Bang. So these objects are quite bright, and they can be detected at very large distances. Now, the fact that they are so distant means that their energy release is enormous, and it was realized early on that it requires quite an extraordinary source of energy. And so essentially, the standard picture of gamma ray bursts these days involves kind of three ingredients. The first one is that there's some system, really the favored ones are the core collapse of a very massive star or the merger of a neutron star binary system that leads to the formation of an accreting black hole. And the black hole is accreting at very high rate, of order a few tenths of a solar mass per second. And that accretion process, in some way, leads to a relativistic outflow. Okay, so that's the first ingredient, is what we call the central engine. That outflow is probably not a steady outflow, but has some instabilities in it. And that internal shocks within this flow are then thought to lead to the emission of gamma rays. And the Lorentz factor of this outflow is enormous. It's somewhere between at least 100, maybe up to 1,000. And that was recognized early on, because the only way to extract from a process like this the observed properties of gamma ray bursts is to invoke a very large Lorentz factor for the outflow. Otherwise, the outflow will be optically thick, opaque, and will lead to thermal radiation, which is never observed. Now, eventually, this outflow interacts with the surrounding environment. It decelerates to about Lorentz factor of 10, and from there it decelerates even further. And that gives rise to the so-called afterglow. So that's where the X-ray, optical, and radio emission come from. So the gamma ray emission looks something like this. It's highly variable. It lasts anywhere between about a tenth of a second to about 1,000 seconds. So there's quite a broad range. Whereas the afterglow lives for a lot longer. So here is an afterglow in X-rays up here, optical and radio. And you can see that the afterglow emission goes out, at least in this case, to 100 days after the burst was discovered. And in some cases, the afterglow emission can be detected for many years. Generally, it starts bright and then just fades away. A lot of the information that we gain about gamma ray bursts comes from the afterglow. What we can determine from the afterglow are critical things like the opening angle of the outflow, and I will come back to that later. The overall energy scale of the blast wave as it interacts with the surrounding medium, as well as we can measure the properties of the surrounding medium as this blast wave is propagating through the medium. And that can tell us something about what kind of source has actually produced a gamma ray burst. Massive stars or neutron star binaries live in very different environments in their galaxies, and they will lead to very different properties of the afterglow. So I will come back to the afterglow in the second half of my talk as a way of understanding these properties of the explosion. Now, the energy scale, at least for the long duration gamma ray burst, after correcting for the fact that the outflow is collimated in jets, is similar to supernova energy, so about 10 to the 51 ergs of kinetic energy. But the key difference relative to supernovae is that it's collimated in a jet with an opening angle of about 5 degrees, where supernova explosions are essentially spherical. And the Lorentz factor is 100, whereas in supernova explosions, the typical velocities are about 10,000 kilometers per second. So the key difference is that in the supernova, the star blows out several solar masses of material. Here, the jet has to entrain at most 10 to the minus 5 solar masses of material to achieve these highly relativistic velocities. So this is quite a spectacular kind of explosion. Now, the other interesting piece of information that came out from the BATSE data set was that the distribution of durations of gamma ray bursts is actually bimodal. So you can see that it extends from about 10 milliseconds all the way up to 1,000 seconds, but it's broadly composed of two roughly Gaussian distributions, one centered at about 30 seconds or so, and the other one at less than 1 second. And this bimodality in the durations suggests that there's some bimodality in the sources that are producing gamma ray bursts. Now, in the BATSE sample, about 1 out of every 4 GRBs was a short burst, and the sample that I will talk about today, coming from the SWIFT satellite, which is the one that has allowed us to establish the detailed properties of short GRBs, about 1 out of 10 GRBs is of the short duration category. So that means that about once per month, SWIFT finds a new short gamma ray burst, and then we follow it up with observations from the ground and from space. So that's essentially the program that we have going on at Harvard that we've been running for the past several years to try to understand both the short and the long duration gamma ray bursts. And so the idea, just to give you a sense of how we actually do these observations, is that we get alerts from the SWIFT satellite within about a minute of when a GRB was discovered. And once we get this alert, which comes to our cell phones, we trigger a whole range of observations at facilities on the ground and in space. So various large optical telescopes, radio and millimeter telescopes, X-ray telescopes in space, and the Hubble Space Telescope. And the point of all of this is that the afterglow emission is very broad in nature. It extends all the way from radio to X-rays. And the only way we can extract all the detailed information that I was talking about, the geometry of the explosion, the energy scale, the density of the surrounding medium, the only way we can do that is through tracing the emission all the way from radio to X-rays. If we only had observations at one part of the spectrum, we would not be able to get unique information. Now, we also use these telescopes not only to study the afterglow, but once it fades away, we can go and study the properties of the galaxies in which these events occurred and use that information to tell us something about what kind of sources are producing them, what the progenitors are. Just to give you an example, this is a recent short-duration gamma ray burst that happened in June of this year, to give you kind of a sense of how we do these observations. The burst was discovered by SWIFT. Within about 30 minutes, we already triggered observations at the Magellan telescopes in Chile. A few minutes after that, we triggered radio observations with a very large array. Within 6 hours, we have already discovered the optical afterglow. So here it is here, this blue source right next to this galaxy over here. And then within a few hours after that, we measured the distance to the burst, a redshift of 0.36 or so. We discovered the radio emission after about 10 hours, triggered more X-ray observations. This is all within 12 hours. A few days later, Hubble Space Telescope observations of this source were acquired, and I will talk about later in a talk. And 4 days after that, we already had a paper submitted on the properties of this burst. Okay, so it's a really fun field to work with, to work in. Everything moves really rapidly, both the observations, and then there, it's quite competitive, and so we write papers.
Does the GRB lead to a paper, or some of them are boring?
Not everyone leads to a paper. Some of them lead to multiple papers, so it kind of averages out. This particular event was quite exciting, and I'll come back later on and tell you why this was a particularly exciting event. So the first thing I want to talk about is using information about the locations of short GRBs, what kind of galaxies they're in and where they are located within their galaxies, that will tell us something about what their progenitors are. So I'll start from that and then go back to the afterglow. And the reason I want to do that is because location, as we know from real estate, is kind of a key thing. And for different types of astrophysical transients, it's actually an extremely powerful test of what the progenitor systems are. So just to give you an example, here's the distribution of three different kinds of supernova explosions, 1A, 1BC, and type 2. So this is their rate as a function of galaxy type. So in ellipticals, in S0 galaxies, and then these are different types of spiral galaxies. And one thing you can see very clearly from this, even if you know nothing else about what these designations are, you can see that these sources called type 1A happen more or less in every type of galaxy with the same rate, whereas these sources called 1BC and type 2 never happen in elliptical galaxies. They only happen in spiral galaxies. So even if you knew nothing else about the properties of what these sources are, what these designations actually mean, one thing you can quickly conclude from this kind of information is that the type 1A events come from some sort of an old stellar population, because they happen in both ellipticals that have no star formation and in spirals, whereas these types of supernovae, the 1BC and the type 2, only happen in spiral galaxies where there is active star formation, come from a young stellar population. So just by knowing what galaxies these different kinds of supernova explosions occur in, you already learn a lot. And in fact, the type 1A events are thought to come from the thermonuclear explosions of white dwarfs, whereas the 1BC and type 2 are thought to come from core collapse of massive stars, and therefore only happen in environments with star formation. So this kind of information has also led us to the conclusion that the long-duration gamma ray bursts come from the death of massive stars. So I just want to walk you through a few of these key points of why we think that's the case. And I'll also use that as a way of contrasting with the properties of short GRBs to show you why short GRBs definitely do not come from the death of massive stars and have to be produced by some other sort of progenitor. So the first thing is that just like the core collapse supernovae, the type 1BC and the type 2, long-duration gamma ray bursts only occur in star-forming galaxies. Okay, so we never find them in galaxies that have no indications of ongoing star formation. So that's already giving us a clue that they are related to star formation. Now, if we ask not only what kind of galaxies do they occur in, but where do they occur within their galaxies, we find a distribution that looks like this. So this is just the distance between the position of the burst and the center of the galaxy in which it happened, normalized by the size of the galaxy. So if GRBs not only occur in star-forming galaxies, but occur where star formation is happening, they should trace that this line over here. And you can see, in fact, that the locations of the long GRBs trace where star formation is happening inside galaxies. So not only are they in star-forming galaxies, they're actually where the star formation is happening. Now, there's another way to look at it, which is slightly less intuitive, but I want to spend time on this because I will come back to this point with short GRBs to contrast. One can also ask, how are long GRBs tracking star formation, not just relative to the center of the galaxy, but in individual regions? And so this is a cumulative distribution of the brightness at the location of the GRB relative to the brightness of the rest of the galaxy. So for example, if GRBs, long GRBs, occur in particularly bright star-forming environments, their distribution will tend to be pushed in this direction, where they're happening at the brightest part of the galaxy. Whereas if they just trace the run-of-the-mill average star-forming environment, they would track this diagonal line, which is the line kind of one-to-one correspondence. And what you can see is that the blue distribution, which is the long-duration gamma ray burst, in fact is concentrated in the brightest regions of their galaxies, whereas the red distribution, which is normal supernova explosions, core collapse supernovae, is just tracking the run-of-the-mill star-forming region. So what this is telling us is that the sources that are producing the long GRBs, the massive stars that produce them, not only are they happening in star-forming environments, they're happening in the regions of the galaxies where star formation is most intense. Okay, so they require probably the most massive stars, or massive stars with some particular properties. And in fact, we know that the rate of long GRBs is only about 1% of the rate of supernova explosion, so they do require very special conditions. And finally, not related to the galaxy types, long-duration gamma ray bursts are actually accompanied by supernova explosions. And so whenever we see a nearby long-duration gamma ray burst, about 10 days to 2 weeks after, we see a supernova at the same place. Of course, there's a delay because the light of the supernova initially goes up until the explosion becomes optically thin, and then we see it. The explosions happen at exactly the same time. So through this mechanism, we know directly that a massive star exploded whenever a GRB occurs. And this is what these supernovae look like. Okay, so we have direct evidence both from, yes?
So then the long GRBs
So they are a manifestation of some supernova explosion. So like I said, it's only about 1% or less of supernova explosions that produce a gamma ray burst in addition. But every gamma ray burst is accompanied by a supernova. The 1% is after correcting for beaming, yeah. And the beaming correction is about a factor of 100. Well, every one where we can observe the signature of a supernova. So the supernova is much fainter than the gamma ray burst itself. We can only see it for the nearby ones. When we can see that signature, it's there. And from there, we extrapolate to the ones where we can't see it. There have been a variety of speculations that have to do with things like the metallicity of the progenitor star, that it might require a fairly low metallicity to maintain high angular momentum. Remember that the ingredient that's unique to gamma ray bursts seems to be the formation of a black hole accreting from a disk, and so large angular momentum will lead to the formation of an accretion disk. They are also potentially the most massive of these types of stars, so that they produce a black hole at the end of core collapse instead of a neutron star. So there are some people have argued that they must be in binary systems, that single stars are not going to produce GRBs. So it's still an open question, but the reality is that they're a fairly rare subset of supernova explosions. That's also been argued about. There are models showing that, in principle, one could power the energy scale of a gamma ray burst with a magnetar. With a rapidly spinning, highly magnetized neutron star. And they may not strictly require a black hole. But you know, at this point, these are just theoretical calculations. I mean, we don't have, right now, any direct observations that tell us what the actual compact object is that was produced. OK, so that's long-duration GRBs. It's now well established that they come from the death of massive stars. What about short GRBs? Well, it's long been suspected that short GRBs result from coalescence of neutron star or neutron star black hole binaries. And the reason is that the very short durations that we observe, down to a few milliseconds, mean that the scale of the system has to be much smaller. The dynamical time is short, and these require systems that are of order tens to hundreds of kilometers in size, not something like a massive star, which will have a natural time scale of tens of seconds when it collapses. And so neutron star binaries seem like an attractive system. The model makes some very clear predictions that we are now in a position to actually test with observations. So let me just guide you through these predictions, and then I will actually show you what observations we have that support this model. So first, we do not expect supernova associations. Of course, the neutron stars themselves, or the neutron star black hole, were formed in a supernova, but that happened millions to billions of years before they eventually merged to form the gamma ray burst. So we're not going to see a supernova explosion at the same time as the gamma ray burst. Delay time between the formation of the system and when it finally merges is expected to be broad because the initial separations are going to be broad. And so it's anywhere between a few tens of millions of years to many, many giga years. And as a result of this broad distribution of delay times, we also expect that these systems will occur in diverse environments. So the ones that merge quickly could happen when star formation is still going on in the galaxy, whereas a system that took 10 billion years to occur will happen in a galaxy that is no longer forming stars and will be an elliptical galaxy. So unlike the long GRBs, we do not expect these to occur only in star-forming galaxies. And that has implications for the redshifts too. For example, if the typical delay was 10 billion years, then we will not find these type of gamma ray bursts at redshift 1 when the universe was only 6 or 7 billion years old. Right? That means that we will preferentially find these systems at very low redshift. So the redshift distribution will tell us something about the delay. Another expectation is what's called kicks. And so remember, these systems form in supernova explosions. These supernova explosions are thought to be asymmetric. And so the system can receive a kick at its birth that over the merger timescale could carry it to large distances from its birth site. So it could travel potentially tens or even hundreds of kiloparsecs away from where it was born. That's a clear prediction of this model. So that means that we should be able to find some of these systems, or they will occur, some of them will occur well outside of their galaxies. Another expectation, yeah?
Why would they remain bound?
Well, if the kick is not, some kicks will be strong enough to unbind the system, in which case, from our point of view, that's over. But some of the kicks will not unbind the system, right? And in fact, one can have kicks that will move the system at 100 or even several hundred kilometers per second without unbinding the system. Another expectation is that in this merger process, some of the material actually gets dynamically flung out or could be ejected from any wind that forms in the accretion disk. This is unusually neutron-rich material compared to other types of environments. And so this is an attractive site for R-process nucleosynthesis. And I'll come back to this later. And finally, the clearest prediction of this model is that short-duration gamma ray bursts, if they come from this model, should be accompanied by gravitational waves. And in fact, gravitational wave emission, that's in the frequency range of advanced LIGO. Now, people have discussed other models. Yes? Sorry, I didn't catch the proper. Well, I mean, one can dynamically form these systems. So for example, it's been discussed that globular clusters are an environment where one can form these systems dynamically because there are very high densities of sources. And that's a possibility. I think right now we don't have a clear way of distinguishing, but even the most optimistic calculations suggest that the contribution of these kind of systems will be at most a few percent of the rate of neutron star binary mergers or neutron star black holes. Now, of course, we know of neutron star binary systems in the Milky Way that will merge within a Hubble time. So that, at least we know this process should happen in the universe. We right now do not know of the existence of any neutron star black hole systems, and so it's unclear if they contribute to short GRBs at all. Another possibility, at least one other possibility that's been proposed, is that these short bursts are caused by giant magnetar flares. And again, magnetars exist. They're thought to be the sources that power short gamma ray, soft gamma ray repeaters, which in many ways have characteristics that are similar to short duration GRBs, but unlike short GRBs, they repeat, as the name suggests. And they're thought to be caused by dissipation of the magnetic field of magnetars. These magnetars are generally found in star-forming environments, in star-forming galaxies. They're young. The energy scale is probably not as large as what can be found here, so they will probably be only nearby. And even though these are also neutron stars that can have kicks, because they're so young, they haven't had a chance to travel away from where they were born. And so we will expect to find these systems associated with star formation, unlike these ones. OK, so those are the predictions of the model. Let me start showing you some of the observational evidence that we have. So first, it turns out that some short-duration gamma ray bursts indeed happen in elliptical galaxies. So these are galaxies with no evidence for recent star formation activity. And here are three examples. So these are the localizations of the gamma ray burst. You can see here, this is the afterglow fading away after a couple of days. Here's the afterglow position with a galaxy. And unlike the long GRBs, which always happen in coincidence with star-forming galaxies, at least some short GRBs, in fact, happen in these elliptical galaxies. And we can tell from the spectra of these galaxies that they have not had any star formation activity for at least a billion years. Okay, so, and the lifetime of massive stars is only a few tens of millions of years. So all the massive stars in these galaxies have died a long time ago. Okay, so this is already telling us that short GRBs are not produced by the same type of sources as the long duration gamma ray bursts. They come from an older population of sources. Now, some of these short GRBs are also nearby enough that if they were accompanied by supernova explosions, we should have been able to see those explosions. And we have gone out and looked for that signature. And the limits are ruling out any supernova association. So here's an example. This is the expected brightness of a supernova if it was there. And these are the observed limits. Okay, so those limits are about a factor of 10 times dimmer than what a supernova should be. And here's another example. These are different supernova models, and these are the limits much below. So these are the same types of supernovae that are associated with long GRBs. The 1BCs, yeah. Okay. In fact, we now have enough of these systems that we can place limits for quite a few of these objects. So this is the distribution of the supernovae that are associated with long GRBs. You can see that it's quite narrow. They more or less have the same brightness every time, within a factor of about 20% or so. And then we have these objects down here, the short GRBs, where our limits are something like a factor of 100 dimmer than these supernovae. So they're clearly not associated with supernova explosions. Well, 1As are roughly the same brightness as a long GRB supernova. Yeah. Now, what's interesting is that these limits that we have here are for short GRBs that happened in spiral galaxies. So even though there's star formation in these galaxies, which might lead you to think, well, maybe these short GRBs are coming from massive stars, the fact is that these short GRBs are not accompanied by supernova explosions. So they're not coming from massive stars, even though some of them happen in spiral galaxies. The other interesting thing we can look at is the distribution of redshift. So remember, I told you that the redshift distribution tells us something about the age of the progenitors. So that's shown in this diagram. So imagine that we form these neutron star binaries at the same time that star formation is happening in the universe. But then there is some delay between the formation of the system and when it eventually merges to form a short GRB. If the delay is, let's say, typically 6 billion years, then the redshift distribution will be skewed to lower redshifts because it takes a very long time for the merger to occur. Whereas if it's, for example, 3 billion years, we should be able to find short GRBs to higher redshifts. So the redshift distribution is a chronometer of the typical merger time. And we can actually compare the redshifts. And so this is the observed redshift distribution. In some cases, we just have a lower limit, so we know that the redshift is even higher. And so you can see that with this redshift distribution, for example, we can rule out this blue curve, which is a typical delay of 6 billion years. So what we know from the current distribution of redshifts is that the typical age, the median age for these systems to merge, is less than 3 billion years or so. So that's already telling us something about the progenitors. Now, we can address that in another way, the distribution of ages, which is, imagine that the typical delays are very long. That means that short GRBs have nothing to do with star formation. The delay is so long that the only thing that matters about how often they will occur in different types of galaxies is how much stellar mass is in these galaxies. Now, we know that roughly in the universe, at least out to redshift 1 or so, about half of the mass in stars is in spiral galaxies and half of it is in elliptical galaxies. So that means that if the typical delay is very long and the only thing that matters is the amount of stars, then half of short GRBs should occur in spiral galaxies and half of them should occur in elliptical galaxies. Now, if we find a distribution that's different from that, for example, that more of them happen in spiral galaxies, that will tell us that actually star formation is somewhat important, and that means that some of them are happening at delays that are only a few hundred million years. So they're influenced by the presence of star formation, even though they're not directly associated with massive stars. So that's, again, something we can test. And so we've now gone out and collected a large sample of galaxies that hosted short GRBs. And what we find is that only about 10 or 15% of them happen in elliptical galaxies, whereas at least half of them happen in star-forming galaxies. So it's telling us that actually star formation is playing some role in elevating the rate of short GRB occurrence. That means that some of these delays between the formation of the stars and the eventual formation of a short GRB is relatively short. It's only a few hundred million years.
Yeah. So the sample that you have that has the same stellar mass in elliptical and in star formation?
Well, let me get back to that. So that's the next slide. So we can also ask that question again by essentially looking at the actual masses of the galaxies in which these occurred and compare it to our expectations for just drawing galaxies from the mass function of galaxies, which is well known. So that's shown here. So the red curve is the stellar masses of elliptical short GRB host galaxies. And the magenta curve is the expectations from the mass function of galaxies. And you can see that they match extremely well. So it's telling us that in elliptical galaxies, short GRBs, the rate of the occurrence tracks stellar mass. The galaxy that's more massive will have more short GRBs occurring there. Now, the spiral galaxies are here, and the expectation is this curve over here. And you can see that they're systematically less massive. That means that the rate of occurrence of short GRBs in star-forming galaxies per unit mass in stars is actually higher. It's about 3 times higher than in elliptical galaxies. So what this means is that the rate of short GRBs in spiral galaxies is influenced not only by their mass, but also by their star formation activity. And that's actually very similar to type 1a supernovae. So type 1a supernovae, even though they come from old systems, occur more frequently in spiral galaxies than in elliptical galaxies. And we see the same thing here. Essentially, it's telling us that there is a distribution, a broad distribution of delay time. Sometimes the systems, the explosions, occur within a few hundred million years of when they were born, when star formation is still ongoing. And we can actually look at the ages of the stars in these galaxies and address that question, and we find that they range from about a few hundred million years to a few giga years. And more of them happen here at shorter timescales than at longer timescales. So overall, the probability of a merger occurring as a function of the delay roughly goes like tau to the minus 1. So there's a higher probability for a merger to occur with a short delay than with a long delay.
I couldn't help but notice that in your pie chart, the biggest pie wasn't spirals or elliptical.
Yeah, I'll come back to those in a second. Sure. But there, whatever way, whatever game you can play, assign all of them to be ellipticals, you always end up with spirals dominating the sample. So we've done different cuts on the sample, and it always ends up that spirals dominate. But I think independent of that, you know, these kind of arguments of actually looking at the properties of the galaxies themselves are telling us that the relatively younger population, the shorter delays dominate. These are still, you know, this is 300 million years. If you compare it to long GRBs, the typical ages of the stellar populations are something like 10 or 20 million years. They're much, much younger. So there's still some delay. Okay, so just a few intermediate conclusions. So one is we know that the progenitors are not massive stars because some of them at least happen in elliptical galaxies where there's no star formation, and they're not accompanied by supernova explosions. We also know that, and I didn't show you this in detail, but the star-forming host galaxies of short GRBs are very different from the star-forming host galaxies of long GRBs. As I just mentioned, they have older stellar populations, and they differ in many other respects. And the type of galaxies and the ages of the stellar populations are telling us that the rate depends on both the mass and the star formation, and roughly follows tau to the minus 1. Now, this is interesting because this is what's expected from basic models of neutron star binary mergers, that the probability of merger roughly follows something like tau to the minus 1. OK, so that's the galaxy scale as a whole. Now let's ask where they're located within their galaxies. And so here are very high resolution images from the Hubble Space Telescope showing the galaxies and the position of the afterglow within the galaxy. And what we can ask is, how far are they from the center? Do we see evidence for these kicks that are expected in the neutron star binary merger model? And in fact, as Avery alluded to, there is a population of objects that we've called hostless bursts. These are events where we know the position extremely precisely, and when we go back, even with the Hubble Space Telescope, we don't see any galaxies at their exact position. So here are two examples. The crosshairs mark the position of the afterglow of the GRB, and you can see there's no galaxy there, and these are very deep images. Okay, the only way we could have missed these galaxies, even if they're there, is to put them at much, much higher redshift than we usually find short GRBs. Okay? Now, on the other hand, there are, of course, other galaxies nearby. And the question is, are these the population with the very large kicks? So maybe this GRB was born here in this galaxy and then traveled all the way here before the merger occurred. And that would be a very powerful signature of neutron star binary mergers. So we can assess that by looking at the probability of finding these galaxies in this environment by sheer accident. And if we find galaxies that should not be there by accident, that will tell us that the GRB could have originated in that galaxy. Okay, so how do we do that? We just go out from the position of the GRB, and every time we encounter a galaxy, we ask, what is the chance that within this distance I will find a galaxy of that brightness by pure accident? And we know how to calculate that because we know the area of the circle, and we know the number density of galaxies as a function of brightness on the sky. Okay? So I can do that for every field, and then I find something like this. So here's the cumulative probability for these hostless gamma ray bursts as a function of separation in arcseconds. And you can see that I encounter a lot of different galaxies, but the probability of finding them by chance is something like 10 or a few tens of percent, not unexpected. But then I get to some separation where I find very low probability galaxies at that separation. So what this is telling us is that these galaxies, for example, this one over here, should not be there by accident. The probability that the galaxy like that is there and not associated is very small. It's less than 1%. Okay? Now you can say, well, how certain am I? Well, I can repeat that exercise for other short GRBs that have coincident galaxies and look if to see whether a similar signature occurs. And the answer is no. So what I find is that the ones that have coincident galaxies at their position show that there is a galaxy there with a very low probability of being there by chance and really nothing else. Okay, so this excess of low probability galaxies seems to be a real effect. It seems to be telling us that these GRBs that lack galaxies exactly at their position are in fact coming or associated with other galaxies that are at large separations. Now, if I measure the redshift of this galaxy, I can convert that to a distance. And what I find is that these distances are typically 50 to 100 kiloparsecs. Okay, so that means that these short gamma ray bursts seem to have originated in these galaxies and somehow managed to travel 50 or 100 kiloparsecs away. And really, the only way we can think of to do this is with these kicks, which are a unique signature of a neutron star binary merger. Now, in fact, we can look at the cumulative distribution. So this is the cumulative distribution of offsets, separations from the galaxies for all the short GRBs, shown in red, compared, for example, to long GRBs, shown in black. And you can see that the short GRBs preferentially occur at larger distances from their galaxies, and some of them extend out to about 100 kiloparsecs. Now, these curves over here in the background, the gray curves, are predictions from population synthesis models of neutron star binaries, where they take a large population of neutron star binaries with different merger timescales, different kick velocities, and they ask how far away do they travel before they merge. And you can see that it's actually in very nice agreement with the observations of the distribution of distances of short GRBs from their galaxies. Let me skip this. Now, let me come back to this diagram that I showed early on that seems a bit confusing and now has another set of four lines on it to make it even more confusing. But to remind you, this is a way of telling how well concentrated different kinds of objects are relative to the distribution of light in the galaxy. Okay, so anything below the diagonal line means strongly correlated, tightly bound, tightly correlated to the stellar light. So for example, the long GRBs shown here in black are strongly correlated with ultraviolet light, which is light produced by massive stars. Whereas core collapse supernovae are more linearly correlated. They hug this dashed line. Now, anything on the other side of the line is very weakly correlated. Now, let's look at this thick blue curve. So that is the relation of short GRBs to the distribution of ultraviolet light, to star formation. And you can see that essentially they're very far removed from the line. That means there is essentially no correlation. Okay? Roughly 60% of short GRBs occur where there is no detectable ultraviolet light at all. Okay? Yeah, and then I do a cumulative distribution for all the galaxies. Okay, so essentially what this is telling us is that short GRBs don't know anything about where star formation is happening. They happen in very different environments. Now, what's really striking is the red curve is the correlation between short GRBs and optical light. Optical light only traces old stars, essentially has nothing to do with star formation. Now, if short GRBs were just belonging to an old population and did not have these kicks, they would essentially lie along this diagonal line. But instead, what we find is that about 50% of short GRBs also exist where there is no optical light, where there is no stellar mass at all. So you can see that in the images quite quickly, quite clearly. So here's a galaxy, and here's the location of the short GRB. And you can see this is where the stars are, this is the starlight, and this is where the short GRB is. They're in completely different places. So essentially, what this is telling us is that not only are short GRBs not associated spatially with star formation, they're also not associated spatially with stellar mass. So how do we do that? How does a population of sources form where there is no stars? Well, the only way to do it is to essentially move them away from their birth site to the eventual merger site or explosion site. Right? So what this is telling us, the progenitors, the system that merged here to form the short GRB was born here where the rest of the stars are, but had to travel. It could not have formed here. Okay? So really, what the combination of the distances from the galaxies and how they relate to the light of the galaxies is telling us that these progenitor systems have to move away from where they were born And that is, I think, one of the strongest signatures we have for these neutron star binary mergers. OK, so that's summarized here. All right, so let me switch gears and talk about the afterglows. The key thing I want you to take away from this is we have measurements of the afterglows all the way from radio frequencies up to X-rays. They're generally fainter than the afterglows of long GRBs. So they have the same afterglow emission, but with a lower energy scale and also lower densities. So these are the densities on a scale of about a parsec around the progenitor system. And it makes sense that the densities are low because, as I just showed you, these things are exploding, these events are occurring outside of where the stars are in the galaxy, where the stars and gas is located. So they explode in lower density environments. And that's not surprising. It's a signature of the same process. Now, we can see this in detail here. So this is what I'm plotting here is the brightness of the optical afterglow, the luminosity of the optical afterglow versus the gamma ray energy. And so the blue symbols are short GRBs, and the red symbols are long GRBs. And you can quickly see two things here. One is that the short GRBs have a lower energy scale. Okay, their typical energies are somewhere between 10 to the 49 to 10 to the 51 ergs. This is before correcting for beaming. Whereas the long GRBs are somewhere between 10 to the 51 up to 10 to the 53. Okay? But you can also see that this clear correlation is offset. And the reason is that the brightness of the optical afterglow depends both on the energy of the explosion, which we already see is lower, and also on the density. Okay? So what this is telling us is that, you know, this offset in this direction is telling us that short GRBs have, as an explosion, they're weaker explosions than long GRBs. And then this offset in this direction is telling us that they also occur in lower density environments, which goes hand in hand with their larger offsets.
Is the short GRBs being shown everybody, or is it just one spiral?
This is everything. This is the full sample. There doesn't seem to be an obvious difference, yeah. But you know, the sample is not too big. Once you start slicing it up, it gets tough. OK, what about beaming? So I told you that long GRBs are collimated in jets that are typically about 5 degrees. Do we have any evidence that short GRBs are spherical or collimated? Well, the signature of a jet is something like this, where we see the afterglow fading away, and then there's a break, and it starts fading more rapidly. And that's the signature of essentially seeing the edge of the jet. Okay? So the time when this break occurs, it can be translated to the opening angle. The earlier it is, the narrower the jet is. The later it is, the wider the jet. Okay? So we can actually, we now have several cases where we see these breaks, and we find that the typical opening angles are somewhere between 5 and 20 degrees. Okay? That's the blue symbols are for short GRBs, and the red are for long GRBs. So this is only a few events, but let's say that the typical opening angle is something like 10 degrees. Okay, so this has enormous implications, because if the opening angle is about 10 degrees, that means that the energy scale is about 50 times lower than if we assume that they were spherical, but the event rate is 50 times higher. Okay, so for a typical angle of about 10 degrees, that means that the gamma ray and the kinetic energy corrected for beaming are about 10 to the 49 ergs. That's 100 times less than for long GRBs. So these events are definitely less energetic. But it also implies an important correction to the rate. So the observed rate of short GRBs is about 10 per gigaparsec cube per year. If we correct it by about a factor of 50 and ask how many of these events would occur within, let's say, the LIGO volume, that would be an interesting number to know, we find that it's something like 20 per year. Okay, so what this is telling us is that if short GRBs are indeed coming from these neutron star binary mergers, as I hopefully convinced you, at least based on their environments, then they're telling, and combined with the beaming, it's telling us that LIGO should see about 20 mergers per year. Most of them will be off-axis GRBs. 1 in 50 will be on-axis. OK. Oh, so it will definitely spread as it decelerates, as the outflow decelerates. But this is the initial collimation before the spreading starts. Yeah, so there's some time scale due to relativistic effects on which pressure within the jet, the jet essentially is not fully in causal connection. And only after some period of time, there is, enough time has passed that pressure can start spreading the jet. Okay, so let me now turn, given that we think that that these objects are associated with neutron star binaries, and I already alluded to the connection to gravitational waves, let's spend a few minutes talking about what we can actually learn from all of this, about what gravitational wave sources will look like electromagnetically when LIGO finds them. And the reason we care about this question is because the gravitational wave signal, of course, will tell us a lot about the nature of these merging systems and maybe the equation of state of neutron stars, a lot of fabulous information. But there are certain things that we can only extract if we also had electromagnetic information. Okay, so for example, the distance scale. It's hard to measure the distance scale accurately from the gamma ray emission, but if we could find an electromagnetic counterpart and associate it with a galaxy, we can measure the redshift of the galaxy and the distance. Same for the astrophysical context. The LIGO can pinpoint sources on the sky, but it can't tell us which galaxy they came from, and definitely not what part of the galaxy it came from. But with electromagnetic observation, as I showed you with short GRBs, we can actually say what parts of the galaxy these objects are coming from, and that will tell us something about where neutron star binaries form. Something about the nature of the compact remnant could be encoded in the electromagnetic radiation and will not be visible to gravitational waves. And then, of course, the behavior of the matter after the merger is not something that can be measured from gravitational waves, but whether there are jets forming and the hydrodynamics of, you know, material being flung out, all of that will be manifested electromagnetically. Okay, so there's a wide range of potential counterparts that we can think about that will depend on which angle we're viewing the merger from. So for example, if we're looking on axis, we should see a gamma ray burst, a short gamma ray burst, and the afterglow. If we're looking off axis, then we will not see the short gamma ray burst. But if we're sufficiently close to the axis of the jet, we might still see the afterglow, even if we miss the gamma ray burst, for exactly the same reason that we just discussed, that the jets can spread as a function of time. So after enough time has passed and the jets spread out, we could see it even if initially we're off axis. And then there are other potential sources of radiation that are more isotropic. And the one that is really interesting that I'll want you to talk about is this object called a kilonova, which is essentially, as I mentioned, we expect material to be flung out that's neutron-rich that will undergo R-process nucleosynthesis. And some of these R-process elements are radioactive. They will decay and provide a heat source that will, in turn, produce optical and infrared light. And this is, in principle, detectable. So that's essentially very similar to a supernova explosion. What powers the optical light in supernova explosions is the radioactive decay of nickel-56. Here, it's going to be the radioactive decay of much more massive elements that are produced by R-process nucleosynthesis. But we will see kind of a supernova-like dimmer signature. And that will be spherical, so it could be seen from any direction. The real challenge of finding any of these counterparts is that, as I mentioned, the typical localization area for LIGO is somewhere in the range of tens to maybe hundreds of square degrees. So if we want to find one of these counterparts, we have to search an enormous area on the sky. It's very different from GRBs, where we usually know the position to better than half a square degree. Okay, so we can address the question of how often are we going to see an on-axis short gamma ray burst in coincidence with a LIGO source. And we can do that because we know the redshift distribution of short GRBs. And in fact, we've never seen, in 8 years of observations, we've never seen a short GRB within the distance to which LIGO is sensitive to. So it's already giving you a sense that this is not going to occur very often. But we can extrapolate the redshift distribution down to the LIGO volume and then take into account the fact that SWIFT at any given time only sees about 10% of the sky. So if we add an all-sky gamma ray monitor, of course, we can see a rate that's higher. But what this is telling us is that it will be something like once every 3 years. We will have an on-axis GRB and the gravitational wave detection. Okay, so it's, you know, roughly one out of every 50 to 100 sources. Okay, so that's not going to be a signal that we will be able to see every single time that we have a LIGO trigger. So we want something else. Well, what about the optical afterglow? So the optical afterglow will be very bright on axis, and as we start looking at it off axis, it will be dimmer and dimmer. And we can actually take the on-axis afterglows that we see with short GRBs and calculate what they will look like off axis. We know the properties of the explosion. We can pretend that we're looking at it from a different angle. So here are the on-axis GRBs, and you can see that they're bracketed by these green and yellow curves. Okay? So if I now go to a viewing angle that is twice the opening angle away from the center of the jet, these curves become these curves. So you can see that the yellow curve is now this yellow curve, and the green curve is now this green curve. And the reason why there is a delay is because it takes a certain amount of time for the jet to spread out and come into our line of sight. And by the time it does that, it will be dimmer than when it was on axis. Okay? So we expect something in the range of this green curve to this yellow curve. And here is the sensitivity of different kinds of telescopes. And you can see that this is going to be not impossible, but relatively difficult to see these off axis. And this is twice the opening angle. If we go any more than twice the opening angle, these become so dim that we'll never be able to see them. OK, so what fraction of events are within twice the opening angle? It's about 10% or so. So that means that for about 10%, instead of one every 3 years, maybe two or three per year, we will see an off-axis optical afterglow. Now, what about this kilonova business? So here's, again, the idea. The merger leads to the ejection of some material that's neutron-rich. And that leads to our process nucleosynthesis with the following kind of typical parameters for this ejected matter. The velocity is somewhere between 10 and 30% the speed of light. And the amount of ejected material is fairly low. It's maybe 1% of the mass of the sun, a few percent at most. So what will come out of this is something that will be relatively dim because there's not a lot of energy and material, radioactive material. And because there's very little material, it will become optically thin very quickly, so the duration will be of order a day. So it's kind of like a very fast, very faint supernova. Okay? Now, until recently, I would say until a few months ago, this was just an idea. Okay? It seemed a plausible idea, but we had no observational data to determine whether this actually happens in reality. Now, one of the difficulties that was added to all of this is the recognition that this R-process material will have very different opacity from iron peak elements that are produced in supernova explosions. And the opacity, in fact, is so large that almost the entire optical emission is gone from these sources. And in fact, these will be almost like faint supernovae, but also producing infrared light instead of optical light. So this is what they would look like if there were iron peak elements, and this is the R process elements. You see that it shifted to longer wavelengths. Okay, so what this means is that in the optical, these will be very dim, but in infrared, they should be relatively bright and will only last at most a few days. So recently, we had this gamma ray burst that I talked about at the very beginning, where I showed you this nice sequence of events and how we published a paper after 13 days. So here's why we were so excited about this particular event. So here are the first observations after about 12 hours from the ground. You can see an image here. And here's an image taken a few months later. So this is the same galaxy here and here. And here's a source here that has disappeared. So this is the afterglow. Okay. Now, here are Hubble observations in optical and in infrared that were taken about 9 days after the GRB. And you can see that in optical light, so this is an image taken 9 days after. These are images taken a month later. You can see in optical light, when you compare these two images, there's nothing at the position of the afterglow. So there was nothing there after 9 days, and there was nothing there after a month. In the infrared, there was a source that faded away between 9 days and a month, exactly at the position of the afterglow. Okay. Now, this is quite unusual to have a source that's associated with a gamma ray burst that is so red in its color that it doesn't show up in optical and only shows up in infrared. But this is exactly what we expect for this kilonova counterpart. So this row is observations in optical early on when the afterglow is producing all the light. So these are in optical, the afterglow. OK, so let's compare this. So here are observations of the afterglow as a function of time. And you can see the afterglow fades away like this dotted line. Okay, and here are the observations of the afterglow in infrared, also dotted line, also fading away. And then this source that was detected, the brightness is up here. So it's about 30 or 40 times brighter than what the afterglow should have been. And it's also much, much redder than what the afterglow should be. Okay, so we have this excess of infrared emission 9 days after. What could it be? Well, we can compare it to these models of kilonovae. And here are what these models are. So the solid curves are for an ejecta mass of 10% of a solar mass. So this is the brightness in the optical, and this is the limit in the optical, consistent. And here is the brightness in the infrared. And then the dashed line is a model with 1% of a solar mass. Okay? So you can see that this is exactly what we expect for these kilonova. We expect a bump of emission in infrared on a time scale of a few days with no optical emission. The optical emission is much, much fainter. Okay? And that's what we saw here. Now, it's only one data point, but this is really the first indication that we have for some excess infrared emission that shows up several days after a short gamma ray burst, and it matches the expectations for a kilonova. So we can compare this to the models, and we find that roughly the amount of mass is about 0.05 solar masses of ejecta is required to produce the source that we observed. Now, this has a lot of very important implications. So first of all, in the interpretation that this is really a kilonova, and we really do not have any other explanation for this very large excess by a factor of 50 of infrared light, this is the clearest signature that we have of neutron star binary mergers for a short GRB. So that's nice. The second one is that it's telling us is if this is a typical source, the typical amount of this R process material that's ejected in these mergers, then these sources will be relatively bright when LIGO finds them within a distance of 200 megaparsecs. Okay? In fact, bright enough to be detectable with reasonably large telescopes. And since this signature is supposed to be isotropic, unlike the GRB, this gives us hope that we can find these counterparts for almost every single LIGO source. Now, the other thing that this is telling us is if this is the amount of R process material that's produced in these mergers, if this is kind of a typical number, and we multiply that by the rate of these neutron star binary mergers, which we don't know very well, but we have kind of a rough guess, it suggests that this is where our process nucleosynthesis is happening predominantly, not in supernova explosions, but in these neutron star binary mergers. Now, when this came out, we did a big press release where we talked about this particular aspect because one of these R process elements is gold. Okay? So this is actually, our argument would be is that this is where gold comes from, okay, and platinum and these kind of elements. In fact, you can convert the amount of material, amount of gold that was produced here to dollars, Canadian or US, it doesn't matter. And it's something like 10 octillion dollars of gold produced, right? So that's a lot of zeros. It's 28 zeros, one with 28 zeros. Well, that will crash the market probably if you dump that much gold. But anyway, I mean, this is I think, a very interesting development that if this is really the typical scale for the mass of ejected material, then our process nucleosynthesis is primarily happening in these sources. Okay, so I think that's where I kind of wanted to end things. So just to summarize, I showed you that the progenitors of short GRBs are an evolved population of stars. They're not young, massive stars. They span a wide range of ages, anywhere from about 100 million years to a few billion years. We have a lot of evidence now, part of it circumstantial, part of it preliminary, but I think all the evidence is pointing in the same direction, that the progenitors are neutron star black hole binaries. And that evidence is the fact that some of these happen at offsets of up to 100 kiloparsecs that suggest that they're being kicked, that they're not spatially correlated with where stars are located. So somehow the progenitors had to move from where they were born. The low densities around the explosion site. And now we have this potential kilonova associated with a short GRB, which if we can confirm that with future observations of other short GRBs, I think is really a smoking gun direct evidence for neutron star binary mergers. We have evidence for beaming with a typical correction factor of about 50 that tells us that the energy scale is 10 to the 49 ergs, and the rate that we expect within the LIGO volume is something like 20 per year. So that should get the LIGO people very excited. And given that we now see that they're likely neutron star binary mergers, we can start to learn a lot about how to do electromagnetic searches for counterparts to LIGO sources. And it seems like gamma rays are a great way of finding kind of one every few year counterpart, but optical might really be the way to go to find these kilonova associated with LIGO sources. All right, I'll stop there.
So We certainly have some time for questions. I think traditionally we let the Psi students ask the first few. Any candidates? All right, let's open it up to everybody. Questions that weren't asked during the talk. So I have one. One thing that's different between ellipticals and spirals is that spirals should have quite a lot of gas. Are there models for the difference in the delays that leverage the amount of gas available in the environment?
So you mean as it impacts the density surrounding the progenitor itself, or?
Either. So, you know, I could imagine you'd have dynamical friction in the gas that would drive binaries closer, dominant, and
see, well, I mean, I think the densities that we infer here, and which are somewhat lower than the typical densities of the interstellar medium, suggest that these effects are not going to be significant. But what it's also telling us is that we can see these afterglows. They can be bright enough, even if the density is quite low, which is why we're able to detect them, even if they've been ejected 100 kiloparsecs away and explode in the halo of the galaxy, where the gas density is very low, maybe as low as 10 to the minus 3 particles per cubic centimeter. They can still generate bright enough emission that we can see them. So if we can see them out in the halos, then I think we, you know, that means that we can almost see them in any environment, regardless of the density. But I don't think the densities are high enough to influence the in-spiral of the binary.
Any other questions?
Looks like there's one there.
A long time ago, Kip Thorne used to say that the most exciting thing that LIGO could discover would be gravitational wave sources which had no electromagnetic correlates, because they might be new kinds of matter or dark matter, compact objects, or something like that. Given what you know, is there a chance of tying that down, assuming that they start to see sources?
Well, I think one possibility that right now is hard to pin down is the contribution of black hole binaries, which will produce copious amounts of gravitational waves, but no obvious electromagnetic signature. And there, we're in the same situation as the neutron star black hole binaries, which is that we don't know of any of these in nature. We have never seen one. We can calculate how often they should occur based on models. And people have highly divergent opinions about this. So there are models that predict that black hole binary mergers will be subdominant. There are ones that predict that almost everything that LIGO will see will be a black hole binary merger rather than a neutron star binary merger. So I think that the gravitational wave data will actually tell us what the masses of the merging objects are with some level of precision, and at the very least should be able to distinguish a black hole binary from a neutron star binary. And so that information should come from the gravitational waves, but I think we just have to wait for LIGO to get going, for advanced LIGO to get insight on what the rates are. And same for the neutron star black hole binaries. I think that the challenge of finding electromagnetic counterparts is somewhat divorced from that, in the sense that I can imagine a variety of ways in which a neutron star binary merger detected by LIGO and clearly be a neutron star binary will still will lack an electromagnetic or detected electromagnetic counterpart, because it will just be really challenging to detect the counterpart. And so we might miss quite a few of them.
Can I ask another quick question? Yeah, what about high-energy neutrino correlates? I know that IceCube has been looking for them and not seeing them.
In association with GRBs?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's right. IceCube looked and didn't see anything. I think that places some constraints on some corner of parameter space for the models of the prompt emission itself, the shocks and that produce the gamma ray emission. But those limits essentially apply to the long-duration GRBs. I don't think that they've really looked at a large enough sample of the short-duration GRBs. And given that the energy scale of the short GRBs is 100 times lower, I suspect that the limits are not going to be that interesting.
So couldn't you have like accretion into neutron stars and that could trigger short GRB?
Yeah, so that's, I think, that question of what the remnant is has been floating around for a while, especially for these binary mergers, ever since people have started finding two solar mass neutron stars, suggesting that in principle, you can imagine scenarios where if you had, let's say, two neutron stars that were about 1.2, 1.3 solar mass, and you merge them and some of the mass is ejected, that actually you don't collapse to a black hole after the merger. You leave behind a massive neutron star. And the question I think that's open right now is, will that produce a GRB or not? Oh, so you just want accretion onto it? Well, the accretion rate will be too low to get these energy scales, right? Because to get this energy scale of GRBs in general from accretion, you need to accrete at a rate of about a tenth of a solar mass per second, and you're not going to do that with just accretion. Oh, you want it to collapse? You want accretion-induced collapse of a neutron star? Okay. Yeah, there's at least one paper in the literature that talks about accretion-induced collapse of neutron stars as potential progenitors of GRBs. What I will say is that in that system, you would not expect these large offsets. You would not expect these kicks that we see. Yeah, but remember that it's in these. Kicks, it's usually the second supernova explosion that provides the larger kick because, you know, the masses are lower, right? So here you have your neutron star with a very massive companion. And even if there was a kick, the system as a whole will not move at very large velocity and will not be able to travel these large distances. So I think it will be in tension with the kind of environments that we find short GRBs in. Well, I mean, the question is how much mass you need to accrete to collapse the black hole, right? So typically neutron stars are 1.4 solar masses, but some of them are up to 2. So you definitely have to accrete at least of order a solar mass to collapse it to a black hole. And so, you know, you can't have a typical half solar mass companion. Yeah, I think that it's hard, I think, to rule out right now that there is multiple contributions to the short GRB population. I think the dominant one has to be these binary mergers, but what are some cases are accretion-induced collapse? I mean, the other thing is that I don't think it's been demonstrated that accretion-induced collapse, even though it's an attractive process, that it will necessarily produce the right conditions to give rise to a GRB. It could produce something else that's not a GRB, some sort of a weird supernova or, you know, who else. Yeah.
I want to make sure I understood something you said. Did you suggest that heavy elements are not primarily produced in supernova explosions?
No. So I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that in the R process, heavy elements, so not the iron peak, which is definitely dominated by supernovae, and lighter elements, but the very heavy elements, you know, kind of A of 100 and above, which require R-process nucleosynthesis. What I'm saying is, given these observations, and it's been suspected for a while, but given these observations, seem to be predominantly produced in these binary mergers rather than in supernova explosions. But, you know, the iron that we see in the universe, the carbon, the oxygen, those are not coming from these mergers.
I see. If that's true, then do measurements of the abundance of some of these very heavy elements tell us something about the rates of these merger processes?
Yeah, so people have, in the past, people reversed the problem exactly in the way you're suggesting. So they would say, we think that about a hundredth of a solar mass is produced in each one of these mergers. We know the abundances, so that places an upper bound on the rate of neutron star binary mergers to not overproduce our process abundances. And what you end up with is an upper bound on the rate that is roughly in agreement with the known or the range of rates for neutron star binaries that people think about. So the argument works essentially kind of both ways. It's consistent both ways.
One other question. In the beginning, you showed the long gamma ray burst. They seem to have these two peaks. Is that typical, or was it just an accident? And is there some understanding why you'd get these two peaks?
You mean in a gamma ray emission?
Yeah.
The gamma ray emission is extremely diverse. And in fact, if you can look at 1,000 light curves in gamma rays, and they it's very difficult to find any order. So there are bursts that show two peaks with a separation of quiescent period of 100 seconds. There are some that are a single peak. There are some that are 100 different pulses. That's not understood because the actual radiation mechanism to produce the gamma emission is not well understood to begin with. So yeah, there's an enormous diversity in the duration and also in the behavior of these gamma ray light curves.
So I think the final question is at an octillion dollars, how close is the nearest one, and is it economically feasible to go get it? Let's thank Ido again.